CliffCentral.com.
Natie Kirsch is a captain of industry. He's an entrepreneur. He's a man who's built business after business. He's had more than his fair share of trials and tribulations along the way. But he is now a man who has a global business empire. There's property, there's retail, there's a whole lot of very interesting stuff going on in there. He lives all over the world, but he still considers, I think, South Africa home. Is it fair to say that?
Certainly, South Africa, the government can't mess up the weather and it's beautiful. So we spend a good deal of time here and enjoy the benefits of South Africa enormously, but we're also enormously concerned about the situation in South Africa, which has many facets to it, not least of which is the element of danger, and every day you heard of another person being held up or robbed, mm-hmm. And the lack of good policing is really a concern. And therefore, when one comes to South Africa, one has always got to be on the lookout and always be concerned about one's own safety, which does not apply in most major countries in the world.
Well, let's start with South Africa, because you absolutely highlight one of the big problems that I think all South Africans feel. But I'm interested in your take on our economy at the moment, and you stay abreast of all the stories that are in the news about South Africa, and I'm sure you're aware that, you know, we talk about the State of the Nation. I think next week the President delivers his State of the Nation address, which is supposed to set the agenda for the year. How would you advise, and I'm sure that you do talk to people all over the world who ask for your advice on how to get things working when they're not. Clearly our economy's in trouble. How would you say we should start kicking it into gear?
Well, you know, there are troubles that come your way and troubles that you create for yourself. The troubles that come one's way are things like raw material prices. We are a big export nation of basic products such as iron ore, coal, and other raw materials. And these prices have crashed in the last 2 years enormously, and that, of course, puts stress on us. But one also continually talks about the creation of jobs in South Africa, and the jobs in South Africa need industry and the development of industry. And I'd like to just recount one of the tragedies of the South African industrial world, which took place some decades ago. And that is, once upon a time, 20 years ago, 25 years ago, we had a fantastically strong and vibrant textile industry. There were wonderful spinning mills, weaving mills, dyeing facilities, and the textile industry was a very vibrant industry, the Frame Group and many others. And I myself had built some wonderful textile mills in Swaziland, which was in a common market with South Africa. Mm-hmm. And the South African government, in their wisdom, opened the South African market to competition from the Chinese. Now, when you talk about competition, nobody is against competition. Competition, per se, as a method of doing business, is a good thing. But when you're opening your market to Chinese competition, you're dealing with a mammoth giant, the biggest economy in the world by numbers, and in these particular products, textiles, the biggest in the world. They have massive production capacity, and when they see South Africa open to them as a market, their marginal production that they can just push into South Africa at extremely low prices, they did just that.
Counts everyone else out.
But it didn't count. It just destroyed the South African industry. And I don't know how many tens of thousands of jobs went with it directly, and how many indirectly a great, great number. And certainly if somebody wants to do a proper appraisal of what actually happened to that textile industry and how many jobs were lost. And it's unfair competition because you open your market to the Chinese who dump their surplus capacity in your market at absolutely no profit or no element of profit, and all the costs already absorbed by the other thing, by their other markets. So it's just destroys your industry. And overnight, the whole South African textile industry, which took decades, many decades to build, was destroyed.
And you're concerned that that might happen
now,
in other industries?
Now, if you look at what is happening at this very minute, if you just read your daily newspapers, where are the big industries in South Africa? The big industry in South Africa, textiles was one, that's gone. The other big industry is steel. And ISCO, which for years was government owned, became a very, very large and efficient producer of steel. It was taken over by foreign interests,
ArcelorMittal,
and the other big steel outfit in South Africa is the one that Anglo developed.
Highfelt, yeah.
Highfelt Steel. And when you, and I quote from the newspapers that say that China produces 50% of the world's steel production. And South Africa has opened its market to Chinese steel exports. And exactly what happened to the textile industry is in the process of happening to the South African steel industry. China has got a bit of a downturn in its own markets. It has surplus steel capacity, and it's buying iron ore wherever cheaply they can, whenever they can, where they can. South African producers have some contracts, I would presume, with local suppliers. I'm also told that the cost of manufacturing steel, 30% is power. And with Eskom, power costs going up.
That's also a problem.
Also an issue. So here you have Chinese dumping their surplus capacity, not only in South Africa, but around the world. So to the extent that South Africa had overcapacity for its own needs and exported steel, the steel that they export now is up against Chinese steel, which is cheap and abundantly in abundant in supply. But worse than that, the Chinese are dumping steel into the South African market, and in very short time, those huge plants, the steel plants that ISCO built, the steel plants that Highfelt built, will all be closed.
And more job losses.
But it's more than more job losses.
The whole industry wide.
It's steel in particular is an industry that generates a lot of byproduct jobs in many different ways, from skills to God knows what. I don't want even to describe it. But when you're dealing with really heavy industry, it does all kinds of things. And generates all kinds of additional income. And to me, one would say, how is it that government allowed this to happen? And my gut feel is that the people in charge just have no experience. They don't realize the destructive forces that they do. When you enter into an agreement with China, to allow China to sell into your market, and in the reciprocity is that you can sell into their market. When you've got nothing to sell to them, and they can dump stuff and destroy your major, the biggest single industry in South Africa, the biggest single industry by far, must be the steel industry. I can't believe that there's anything bigger than that. And to have this destroyed by just being undercut, it's just dumb. And certainly, by the government, it would not be happening.
Now, Nathie, a lot of people talk about the importance of small and medium enterprises and people who start these small businesses, and that might be the only thing that we can do to create work and to create jobs for people. How would you go about tackling that? Because certainly government talk a good game in terms of small businesses, but they don't seem to give them any advantage and they don't seem to be able to give them any kind of foothold.
Well, you know, small businesses come in many shapes and forms and many sizes. So let me just stop for a moment. In order to have businesses, you have to have demand. Mm. And small businesses piggyback on large businesses. So when you have a vibrant economy, you have the opportunity for small business opportunities. When you have a dormant economy or a dying economy where your major industries are going flat, where your export potential is going to hell, and your prices you're receiving for your export is very depressed, it's very troublesome on how you get small businesses going. I myself am a great believer in small businesses, and in Swaziland in particular, I run a thing called the Inchlan Yellow Fund, which is a seed fund, where we provide startup capital for people who want to start their own businesses. And over the last 15 years, we've financed 14,000 startups in that little country.
And an incredible success rate, right?
We have about a 70% success rate, but they're small businesses. But it's wonderful when you provide money for a woman to buy a couple of sewing machines, and 10 years later, she's got 20 machines and employing 30 people and making garments for the schools and for this and for that. And so there are many, many examples of that. I do it in other parts of the world as well. But in South Africa, I must qualify things by saying that I do not spend much time in South Africa, and I've been out of South Africa pretty well for 30 years, so I don't have an in-depth knowledge of what the position is in South Africa or the structures in South Africa. But I would imagine that the provision of finance to small businesses needs to be looked at if it's not there already, because basically the key to it, to the key to an entrepreneur's ability to create anything is seed money.
Right, and because you can't start it with nothing.
Yeah, and banks are not good at that, because banks have built into their culture that they have to have security. Mm. And you have to accept a degree of risk and a lack of security to get young people, or smaller business, not necessarily young people, but also older people who've got some entrepreneurial spirit, to get them into business for themselves. But, I never worry or concern myself too much about things that you can do nothing about. So I come back to my view on South Africa at the moment. There's nothing you can do about the price of iron ore or coal or raw material exports. But there's a hell of a lot you can do to stop people destroying your steel industry.
And making bad decisions that have policy repercussions out.
And these have knock-on effects. And if I was looking at South Africa at the moment and looking at where the opportunities lie, I would look at recreating a textile industry and not having somebody just wipe you out, because the skills are there.
So and a bit of protectionism might not be a bad idea.
It's not a question of protectionism. You're not looking to be protected against fair competition.
Right.
You want to be protected against unfair competition. Mm. You want to be protected. You know, it's like putting two people in the boxing ring. The one is the heavyweight, and the one is an under 15 guy learning to box. And he just comes out and he gets smashed.
Sure.
And that's exactly what's happened now. You start off with two young 15-year-olds boxing each other and say, oh, they're doing well. And look at how good that guy is. So now he's the under 15 champion. Now let's put him up against the world, and you bring the world heavyweight champion, because one smack and he's out of the business. and that's exactly the scenario of the South African steel industry now. It was exactly the scenario of the textile industry all those years back. And one's got to be very careful about free trade with uneven competition. You know, free trade is good when there is free and fair competition. It doesn't stand up when somebody can smash you by just pushing into your market stuff that you can never compete with, because it's not critical to them. It's just spare capacity that they're just wiping out with.
How do you respond? I mean, the fact that you've also had this career that's really, you've been involved in so many different industries. You've worked out how property works. You've worked out how Jetro and restaurants and delivering and cash and carry and all of that stuff, how that works. And that's been tremendous, because you grew that from a very small business.
Yeah, my American business is a very large business.
Now, yes, absolutely.
It's actually, by South African standards, it's a mega business. It's probably the most successful food distribution business in the world today. And it's growing, but we're working in a very big market, and we innovate. We've innovated and changed the method of supplying food to the small stores in the major cities and to 250,000 restaurants across America. So every week we have 500,000 restaurants that come and collect their product from us. Every day we have 7,000 these 18-wheeler truckers, 7,000 trucks, loads of product delivered to us in 115 warehouses across the country. So we have a remarkably successful thing, which allows us the cash flow to do a lot of other things. But in the early days in South Africa, I did many things and very successful. And when Buddha shook his finger at the world and interest rates went from 15% to 27% overnight, and I had a partner who was very difficult at the time, and as somebody said to me, they didn't, if I can use the word, screw me, they emancipated you. Yeah. I sold out of South Africa and I went to America and built something much bigger, which gave me the opportunity to do things in other parts of the world. So today I enjoy doing business in places where they speak English and they have the rule of law.
But can we hold on for a second there? Because what happened in South Africa would have leveled a lot of people, and it would have stopped people from being able to make it anywhere else. And you decided not just to turn that into a challenge that you wanted to take on in America and in England and in Australia, but you didn't let the idea that you were the one who lost out here get to you.
No. But firstly, I didn't see any failure on any decision that I made. Some of the guys that worked with me made some decisions that
they built a whole lot of shopping malls.
Well, no. Right. Well, forget about the names, but I'd put a guy in charge of Checkers at the time.
Right.
And he had approached me to give him a parent company guarantee to build a shopping center in a new company. And we said, okay. And we had a look at what the mechanics of it and the economics of it was, and we felt quite comfortable about it. And it was a couple of hundred million rand, and we had to give a bank guarantee for a couple of hundred million rand or an unlimited guarantee. If you give a guarantee for 200 million rand, you pay stamp duty of 1%, that's 2 million rand. If you give an unlimited guarantee, you pay stamp duty of 5 rand. So if you're only doing one shopping center and you know what you're doing,
We'll just get unlimited.
Unbeknown to me, in the next years it progressed, he committed, and at the time Buddha shook his finger at the world, he was committed to 22 shopping centers that were under construction, and the whole economy came to a standstill, and I needed to do a rights issue in Greatermans, which was the parent company of Checkers at the time. And my partner, which was an insurance company, but a minority partner, had some minority protections that I couldn't do rights issues without their agreement, and they wouldn't allow me to do a rights issue in Greatermans, and they said they'd do a rights issue at the top company, which is where I had 51 and they had 49, which would have given them control.
Right.
And I said, I'm not working for you, and I sold out to them at a giveaway price. And, of course, the economy came back over many years. The money that they put into the company, put 170 million in to ride it through the tough times. But I had a very small effect of real interest in these, because through a series of pyramids, my economic interest in this whole vast enterprise that I'd built, which employed 40,000 people, was the third largest industrial outfit on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange. My economic interest was 6.5%, but I had the responsibility for all these guys. So I went to America and restarted my business career at the age of 54. Yep. And I never got myself into the position of being 6.5% again, that I can tell you. So, but none of the things that went sour in my life were of poor judgment on my own part. So I always retained absolute confidence in my own ability to judge and see things correctly and clearly. And this is what astonishes me now, that when I see this destruction of the steel industry, how people responsible for this actually do not see it, you know, and do not see the consequences for South Africa. Now, I can assure you I have no shares in Arcelor, nor do I have any shares in, but I'm just horrified to see how, to use the word loosely, irresponsible the whole policy is.
Does it frustrate you often when you sit down in business with people that they don't see things as clearly as you do? Because it's clear, I mean, it's something that you've obviously picked up with experience, but it's also an innate gift that some people have. You see a path from A to C much quicker than most people. They go via B and a roundabout.
That is true.
I think it is true. It must be frustrating for you to then sit.
No, it's not frustrating. People I deal with are all smart. And I have a unique situation at the moment. I've just employed my replacement as CEO of our group, and it's a chap, a South African, Brad Fried. He comes from Cape Town. He was the CEO of Investec Bank in London. And just to give you an interesting little side story in this discussion, when I asked him to come and join me, he said yes, he'd love to, but he just has to clear it because he's the deputy chairman of an organization. And unbeknown to me, they had a very good look at my organization without me even knowing it. And the reason is because he was going to remain deputy chairman of this organization, and he is deputy chairman of the Bank of England.
Right.
So my CEO, which of course gives us great credibility, because the Bank of England would never allow a deputy chairman to be the CEO of anything that was anything but, if one can put it, absolutely clean. And I can honestly say that I run a very clean organization in the air, which brings us to the next item on the agenda in South Africa, and that's the level of corruption in South Africa, which is horrific. And I'm sure you've read Johnson's book about how long South
it's
Africa...
It's depressing, lost. But it's all true.
Well, you see, if it wasn't true, he'd be sued out of sight. So this element of... it's not corporate dishonesty. This is government dishonesty, and when it starts at the top, and it's fostered, and it's so clear, and everybody sees it, and it's so blatant, and you read it, and it's horrific. So, this when I say I like doing business in where they speak English
and have a rule of law,
and the breakdown of the rule of law, be it at a corruption level or be it at a safety and a criminal and police level, is of real concern in South Africa. And one can only hope that the elements within the ANC, which is not a monolithic party, that are more responsible, will ultimately be motivated to get up and say, we've had enough of this, and we need to put ourselves back into a proper scenario. And in my view, the best scenario that could possibly happen is if parts of the ANC would have the guts to stand up and say, we are going against this, and if they would invite the DA to join them and the and Bantu Kholomisa's party to join them and recreate a government of national unity, which overnight would change the whole structure of the world's image of South Africa. Whoever I've spoken about this concept to has said, and I've spoken to some of the senior bankers, they said, you cannot believe the change that would take place overnight. And one only has to hope that those responsible elements and the honest elements, and there are a lot of honest elements in the ANC, will rebel against the corrupt crowd and reestablish a government of national unity, which would then get South Africa back on the path.
First of all, do you think that's at all possible?
Do I think it's all possible? It needs somebody to be the catalyst to make it happen, and maybe that's going to be happening, and maybe it is happening, I'm not sure.
Right.
But certainly I'm trying to influence that it should happen.
You're trying to influence, but have these people asked you also for your support? Have any of these political parties asked you?
I've spoken to some people in the ANC, and they have indicated, yes, they think it's a great idea. Bantu Kholomisa came to see me, and he thought it was a great idea, and he said he'd put his full weight behind it should such a thing come apart. I'm sure that the DA might well accept this, and I'm quite sure they do, because the truth of the matter is anybody who has the well-being of South Africa ahead in their game of their own personal interests would support this. The only people who might not support it is where they see there's a prejudice to their own political position or their own position of power. So that where you have somebody who really believes that South Africa is number one on the list, and we can fight about political power 10 years down the line or 5 years down the line when we've got ourselves into some kind of credible situation, well, let's just see. I can't tell you. I don't know the players well enough. I don't know whether there's anybody or a cadre of people within the ANC who are strong enough to actually do it. But what might be a catalyst in this situation is the municipal elections. And if the ANC see that they lose a lot of ground in the municipal elections, they can go one of two ways. The bad way, and which is what brought this whole discussion into focus, is that they'll seek populist moves to bolster their popularity amongst the masses. In other words, taking over the land of the country, the farms, breaking it up, giving it to small people, destroying the agricultural potential, and really taking South Africa into a Mugabe type regime. The alternative is it would be the catalyst for the guys to say, we're sick and tired of this.
Let's fix it.
So there's your choice.
Right.
And should there be something in between, God knows, I don't know. But I think even if it is a long shot, it's something worth trying, because basically it would change South Africa overnight.
You've done something that a lot of people don't like to do and don't like to think about. And it goes across from politics to people who have successful businesses and everything else. You appointed your own successor, so you're thinking of the plan for after you, but you're staying very much involved in what you do. You keep an eye on all your businesses. You make decisions that are important at every level.
But I must tell you, I'm not 21.
No, but this is what's so amazing.
I am 84.
84.
And anybody who's 84 and doesn't and is reasonably smart and thinks he's going to go on forever is making a mistake. But when you take a complex business like mine and you bring somebody in who's really smart and you give him time to assimilate the culture, you see, we're a private company. Mm. And as a private company, we can have a culture that is much more philanthropic than a public company, because you're dealing with your own money and you can do what you like with it. And a culture where you can delegate to a much greater extent, because you're not responsible to a third party. So I'm able to delegate to people huge authority and just say to them, If you're comfortable with what you do, do it. If you're not comfortable, just talk. And my successor's job is going to be much more difficult than mine, because he's not going to be an owner. He's going to be the guy who runs it, a manager. And therefore, it's better that I should bring him in and have time with him, and he should have time with me and all of us sitting together for some period of time to make everybody comfortable and to perpetuate that culture of leaving guys to run their businesses, because we run a very flat structure. We don't have millions of boards and things like that. And you guys are not sure. He gives me a ring and he'll give him a ring. And that's and that's how it works. And it works very well for us.
At 84 years old, there's got to be a part of you that, A, doesn't want to stop because it gives you great personal satisfaction. Right, and the other part is that you want to.
But I stopped a long time ago.
Well,
when you give other people, when you delegate the responsibility of running everything, all I'm involved in is discussions with them about their own strategy. I don't run anything. I don't make decisions. I don't make.
I'm sure they attach quite a lot of importance to those discussions.
They inform them. To get your strategy right is important, and that is normally a debate between more than one person, and no one. The big thing is. The secret of anything, and whether it's running a good broadcasting station or running a good wimpy bar, is management. If the guy who runs it does it well, it runs well. And if the guy who doesn't do it well, it doesn't run well. So it's people. It's a choice. If you've got the ability to choose the right people and then give them the authority and the freedom to do what they need to do, it works.
You're sending chills down my spine, because this is something we were talking about today. I'm fascinated, though, by the kind of life story we've got here, because this is really the story also of a South African guy who was born in Potchefstroom, who met and married his wife there so many years ago, who's got this incredible family around him, who also manages to do a huge amount of philanthropy. There must be a huge sense of personal satisfaction at this point. You must feel, you know what, I've done good.
Well, it's the greatest satisfaction there is to do good without putting stress on yourself. You know, once upon a time, wealth was very discreet. Nowadays, you Google somebody or you go into Bloomberg, wherever it is, and you say, oh, Kirsch is worth X billion. Or whatever.
Does that make you uncomfortable?
No, it's a fact. So everybody knows, yes, I'm rich. And if I'm rich, I'm not going to take it with me. And so to the extent that there's reinvestment needed in the organization, that pretty well always takes priority, because that's the nature of running a good business. And so we always make sure that. But then you have an ability to do things beyond that. And much of that is philanthropic. Much of that is helping other people one way or the other, creating things, who knows what. So that's just a situation where I feel very blessed and that I'm able to do the things that I do.
Do you ever sit in rooms with other people? We'll wrap it up now. The other room, sort of these rarefied places where you end up in conversation with all the other people who have such a tremendous effect on the business world, other people who have a tremendous effect on the political world. I would imagine there are some very interesting people that have sat in your dining room.
Inevitably and invariably come across people who are smart, because you gravitate towards people who think the same way and operate the same way and live in the same kind of world that you do. And you always learn from listening to other people's experiences, and the relevance often is not there, but from time to time there is relevance, and when there is relevance, you take it in.
Well, thank you for talking to us on Cliff Central. I hope that we'll hear much more of your wisdom in the coming years, despite the fact that you're letting other people run things, that you still have much to give in terms of the things that you've learned, the things you've seen, and the and the ideas you can impart to all of us.
Well, thank you for your kind words, and a pleasure talking
thank
to you.
Thank you, Nathan. CliffCentral.com.
So that was Gareth with Nate Kirsch. If you want to catch the full interview, go on to CliffCentral.com. Gareth will be back tomorrow. Tomorrow being Tuesday, he went away for a wedding over the weekend, so he'll sure be back in romantic spirits. Maybe he met someone special.
Well, he was at a wedding, after all. And these things can tend to have romantic outcomes.
Yeah.
If you've consumed the right amount of alcohol and you know your beer goggles are working perfectly fine.
And we must totally probe him about it as
yes.
well. Just absolutely won't let him get off lightly, like we did with Sia in his Valentine's story.
Mm-mm.
But before we go, there is a story I wanted to bring up, is that Sports Illustrated is now putting real women on their covers. So we don't get Sports Illustrated in this country anymore, which is a massive shame, because I still believe there's a great market for a great rugby. Why does that always happen to me?
It happens to me too. Don't feel bad.
I still think there's a great market for rugby, cricket, and all the rest in a magazine nowadays. Anyway, so the Sports Illustrated has come out every year with the swimsuit edition. Which has beautiful ladies. And last year or the year before, there was quite a stir because there was this really photoshopped girl. And you could say,
but they're all photoshopped. That's kind of the point of magazine covers. They all get photoshopped.
Yeah, but I mean, like, they've got quite racy, have Sports Illustrated. I mean, you could basically see her bonnet.
Bonnet?
Not get into details.
I'm being PC here, so yeah. I wasn't going to say
that. Can I Urban Dictionary bonnet?
Well, look. Anyway, so now they've got, there's been a whole thing. Have you ever heard of Ashley Graham?
No.
Okay, now Ashley Graham, she's a bit of an activist when it comes to, like, you know, people say plus size models. She's more about just positive body image. So, look, you look at her, you're not going to say she's fat.
Mm-mm.
You're not even going to say this plus size thing is bullshit, actually.
Well, you see,
she just looks really good. She looks natural. She's just a good looking woman.
The problem with plus size is they were trying to make it seem like, bigger than the stick thin model.
Mm.
But a lot of these plus size models are not overweight women.
Exactly.
They're perfectly healthy and yeah. within, you know, the limits of what one would think, oh, that's a beautiful body.
Now, Kate Upson was the first one to kind of break the mold, and that she was very natural and she had her own curves. But now they've actually got proper, like, as I say, curvaceous models now. So, look, what she says, I'm actually going to quote what she says. She's truly speechless. The cover is for every woman who feels like she wasn't beautiful enough because of her size, which is a good point. Like, you look at these things and you go, ugh, look at these bitches. I'm going to have to give up everything for summer now. Everything.
But you know what? We as women, we really need to get over the body issues that we have, because let's face it, if you look at the men that you're trying to impress, ladies,
exactly.
A lot of these assholes don't look anywhere near like a Ryan Reynolds six-pack abs. Or a Brad Pitt's chiseled facial features. Like, a lot of these guys don't look as good as we want them to look.
No, exactly.
Why are we killing ourselves trying to look a certain way?
And then guys have this expectation, like, oh no, she's a belter. And then it's like, oh no, look at her, she's a bit chubby.
I know, and guys seem to think that they deserve a woman who looks like a supermodel. No, you actually don't, especially if you yourself do not look like Ty Diggs or you know, like, everybody just get a reality check, please.
Yeah, well, Sports Illustrated are pioneering this reality check. So there's gonna be three covers, right? So there's I've got a name now.
You mean besides Ashley Graham?
So there's Ashley Graham, okay. So she's the plus size model. And then there's Hayley Clawson, who she's more of your traditional swimsuit issue kind of cover girl. And then this UFC fighter Ronda Rousey. Now they've used body paint on Ronda Rousey. Hayley's basically topless on the cover. She's just covering her breasts.
Oh, hang on. So Ronda Rousey is not wearing anything except body paint.
She's in body paint. Her face looks,
ooh.
Yeah, because she was completely beaten up by that other girl in the ring. So you got three very different body types. So the whole point is, it's like, she's the sporty athletic girl. Ashley is the more curvy girl, and then you've got Hayley, who's like kind of the more slender swimsuit girl. Look, they all look natural. I think it's a good thing.
It is a good thing, because let's face it, at the end of the day, how many of you are actually scoring with supermodels? You're just not. You're dealing with real women.
And real women should be cherished.
These are the facts of life.
Yes, exactly. Steve, before we go, anything you want to add for the week? Motivation, inspiration?
No, Ben, this is not going to be an opportunity for you to get any sort of other details about my life.
How's that for defensive? That's all. Here I was giving him an Oprah moment, and he was like, no, I'm going to tell you about my love life.
That's all.
A time will come, see us on Gwynny Finn. You've got much to share.
I feel like you're trying to crack me open and there's nothing there. Well, you know what I mean.
Don't be so hard on yourself.
Yeah, that's not a good advertisement for yourself. There's
such
nothing
a non-story.
There.
Really such a non-story.
Yeah, there's always a story with you.
Because after such an interview, like, why can't we be all inspirational and motivational and go out there and make money ourselves?
I don't know. When I listen to really rich people, I get quite despondent.
Why?
Because why, Ben?
What do you mean, why?
Well, why? Because are you thinking, I'm never going to be that wealthy?
No, it's just that, like, to be absolutely hugely wealthy involves life-changing hard work. Like that Nate Kirsch, he's been busting his balls forever.
And he's still busting his balls, from what I can tell.
I don't like busted balls. Okay, well, Jane's just coming, she's rattling ahead. Mavs, anything else? Oh, just quickly run us through the lineup again of what to look forward to the rest of the day.
Okay, so coming up next is TG Squared with Dusty Rich.
Yes, Dusty's
this
here.
Morning, resident 27-year-old man going on 12-year-old boy. Dusty Rich brings you the Gas Comedy Podcast.
And nobody wears a wife beater quite like Dusty.
If you don't know what the Gas Comedy Podcast is, you're about to find out, because we don't have a clue ourselves. Then the Bounce Show with Ben Karpinski at 10 o'clock. Now, what did you say you're getting up to this morning?
It's okay, Mavs. I think I've plugged the show so much during these 3 hours already. Just join me back in an hour's time, 10 till 11.
Sports. Young, Wild and Free is up at 11 o'clock. Today, Mangoba is focusing on the themes of 2016 being the year of the woman. Apparently.
New show. Is this his first show, or was he on last week?
No, he's been on for a while now. Okay. I think it's just a matter of having moved his slot around and positioning it in a more permanent position. Then from 12 to 3 o'clock this afternoon is the Leadership Platform with Adrian Groenewald, sponsored by Sibanye Gold. A whole 3 hours of everything from a leadership masterclass to a leader interview of the day. The panel engages directly with Herman Mashaba this afternoon. Then you've got your business skills conversation, you've got your SME interview. So it's a jam-packed 3 hours of just leadership, motivation, just really the kind of
inspiration,
the kind of thing that could really get one focused on what's important in life to get things done. And then at 3 p.m. is the Pan-African Connect with Rosie Mutene, and then we wrap it up with Kelman on Cliff Central between 4 p.m. and 6 p.m.
Very nice. So, Gareth is back tomorrow. Start the week off right. Everyone misses Gareth, but he'll be back tomorrow. And, the show will be as per usual. 20 years since this movie came out. Can you guess which it is?
Oh, she got hit by a car. She's dead.
Sir, could I trouble you for a glass of warm milk? It helps put me asleep.
You could trouble me for a warm glass of shut the hell up. Now, you will go to sleep, or I will put you to sleep. Check out the name tag. You're in my world now, Grandma.
Any guesses?
Sure. I was going to... No, it's not one of those Home Alone franchise things. No, I don't know.
Am I getting 0 for 3 out of you?
Was 3 when it came out, so I wasn't probably not allowed to watch it.
I don't know. It wasn't even like a British accent. It was like Welsh.
Son, what the hell are you doing? 364 more days till next year's Oscar trials.
The Nutty Professor.
No.
It sounded like Eddie Murphy.
Oh, good, yeah.
By the way, thanks for dressing up.
Hey, if I saw myself in clothes like those, I'd have to kick my own ass.
Happy Gilmore, people. Happy Gilmore.
Adam Sandler.
Yeah, that's what really put him on the map. One of his best movies of all time. So, anyway, catch you back tomorrow. That's enough from us. Have a great Monday and enjoy the rest of the shows in the company of CliffCentral.com. Check you tomorrow. CliffCentral.com.